Hey, welcome to another episode of Off the Chain. How you doing, Steele?
Dave, I'm doing marvelous. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited. This is the first time we're going to do an episode where it's just the two of us. We've kept having guests, and I feel like my closeness to you, there's a distance that's grown between us because of that.
Let's get cozy, Dave.
Yeah, let's just share the same couch, same blanket, and just get in there and talk. So this week, we got some interesting stuff ahead of us. We're going to talk about an ostrich festival that I went to that just defines Off the Chain. We're going to look a little bit at March Madness. We're excited for basketball. We actually like sports, despite the fact that I'm a male nurse and Steele enjoys poetry.
Playing against type.
I've got probably my favorite segment that we ever do is Lost the Plot. We've got Steele's going to talk about an action movie that he doesn't know about, and I love to do it. And of course, we've got some Unchained Melodies, a little bit of book wisdom. But Steele, we're going to
Dave,
start with the
I'm
Ostrich
excited.
Festival.
Yeah, that's what I want. I'm dying to know more about this.
So when I say Ostrich Festival, like, what do you think? What do you think's happening there?
So, an ostrich festival, probably just a group of people coming together to celebrate the greatest land bird in world history.
I wonder if there are some emu fans out there that might take exception to that statement, Steele. But I can tell you at the Ostrich Festival, there were thousands of people there.
Here's what I want to know, because I don't know if you know this about me, Dave, but I read a whole entire nonfiction book all about ostriches, written by one of my professors here at the UW. It's called Dream Birds: The Strange History of the Ostrich in Fashion, Food, and Fortune by Rob Nixon. It's a good
So
book.
wait, what does it get into? What's he talking about in the book?
So Rob grew up in South Africa in the desert near where they had this big ostrich boom, where there were hundreds, I guess, of ostrich farmers who were growing ostriches. It was kind of like that pigeon story we talked about last week, where there was people thinking they were going to be able to breed ostriches for their meat or for some kind of fashion need. They used to have women's hats with big ostrich plumes, and it was a boom kind of bust cycle. So he grew up with all these thousands of ostriches, and then he's decided to write a book about why people are into ostriches, I guess.
Well, it is. It's a surprisingly compelling bird. Like, if you're at the
Yeah.
zoo, you're not going to miss the ostriches. You're going to go to that cave, to wherever they are every time.
Yeah.
I learned from the festival last night, they do not actually stick their heads in the sand. At least that's what the sign on the cage said. So I'm not sure if that's accurate, but they told me that.
Cool.
But the main draw is the ostrich races. They actually have the ostriches race, which I don't know how humane that is, but they do it, and everyone loves it.
Are they
Maybe even
written
the
by
ostriches,
human
I'm not
writers,
sure.
or are they just unwritten?
No, human writers, it's like Swiss Family Robinson. If you remember that scene where they all jumped on different animals and raced, it's pretty much exactly like that. I think that's where they got the idea from.
So, did you jockey an ostrich?
Unfortunately, no. I'll tell you the main reason I went there, Steele, is Grand Funk Railroad was playing. Are you familiar with Grand Funk?
Yes, my dad's a big fan.
I think everyone's dad is a huge fan of Grand Funk from the crowd that I saw there last night. Can you name any Grand Funk Railroad songs?
How many do you want me to name?
Yeah, as many as you can. Let me hear. Just throw it out.
Okay, well, obviously everybody knows the classic. We're an American band. There's
Yes.
Some Kind of Wonderful. That's the other, I
Yes.
think, big hit. There's The Locomotion. They have the classic song Bad Time. They've got Walk
Oh
Like a
boy.
Man. That's a good one. And the other one I can think of is Shining On.
Well, if Grand Funk is really bringing it, they're gonna play three songs still. Two of them you named. One of them I know you know, you just forgot. It's the I'm Your Captain one.
Oh,
You know that.
yeah, do I ever?
Well, so we go to the show, and I'm excited, but I decide I'm there to hear We're an American Band. I'm a huge fan of this. We're gonna have to post a link to their music video they made in the 70s for this song because I would submit it as the greatest music video of all time.
Wow.
That's what I'm there for. I want to hear We're an American Band.
I mean, it's both rock music and patriotism in its highest form.
And you don't even know. Of course, at some point, they get an American flag out and they're waving it. They do an electric guitar version of the Star Spangled Banner. But I'm nervous still because I've whipped out my smartphone and I'm looking at previous Grand Funk Railroad set lists. And you know what song is missing from most of their set lists?
Uh-oh. It better not be We're an American Band.
They play it like once every 10 shows. So I'm nervous and I'm yelling. I don't normally yell for songs at shows, but like, this is the whole purpose of my life right now is to hear We're an American Band. But the guys are putting on a terrific show. The lead singer is not the original lead singer, but he's doing a great job. He's doing the whole, like, hey, Chandler, Arizona, you guys are rocking harder than us tonight. He's doing that kind of thing. And there's like a 5-minute drum solo. There's like a 5-minute guitar solo. They're just bringing it. Like if you're in your 60s and you're there to rock, they brought it for you. And they play I'm Your Captain, and I feel like the show's over. But I'm yelling, like I'm literally yelling at the top of my lungs. I almost lost my voice. I'm yelling American Band.
And is anyone else yelling, or are you just the lone man in the crowd just screaming this one song you need to hear?
The reason I'm yelling, because I'm pretty far back, is I want other people to join in. Like I figure, like, who's not going to join me with this? But no one joins in.
What?
But fortunately.
What is wrong with Chandler, Arizona? Don't they love their country?
They do, but they're not as irritating as I am at a live rock concert. No one's on my team.
That's too bad.
But fortunately, the original drummer, is the man that sings the song. He walks out to the front of the stage, and he puts on an Uncle Sam hat, and I know what's coming. He says a couple things about America, gets back on the drum kit, he starts the beat, and they play the song.
Dave, what is an Uncle Sam hat?
Just, you know, look up just a poster of Uncle Sam from like the 40s or 50s, you know, the top hat with the red and white stripes and the ring of blue with the stars in it. He's got this on. He's had it the whole time. I think he's just kind of feeling out the crowd. Like, are these guys patriotic enough? And do they rock hard enough for me to play We're an American Band?
And did he lock eyes with you and say, thank you? Thank you.
He didn't have to mock eyes with me and say thank you because he thanked me through his song. I didn't even know that I knew all the words to the song, but I do still because I was yelling them at the top of my lungs along with him. They just brought it hard. Like it was 60-year-old dudes rocking to the max, playing their greatest song that they've ever been around.
You know, I propose that we change the U.S. citizenship test to just being able to recite the lyrics to this song.
They're solid lyrics. And Steele, you're going to watch that video today, later on, and you're going to thank me because you're going to know what your perfect day would be now. Because you don't, right now you think you know what a good day for you would be, but now, after watching that video, you'll know, like, this would be my perfect day.
Yeah. Ostrich Fest, 20 rows back, yelling, and then getting this song as the encore. See it, Dave. My whole body is
moving. Listen to that cowbell, man.
So good. I'm rolled for 40 days.
Last night in the rock, but man, the haze. Sweet. Playing the drums while I sing it.
Dang. I had the whole show, and that's a natural fact.
No. one has not seen that. Even people that didn't know the song.
I love that they're going to help people party down.
And they did. They came to the town and they rocked this. That's all they did. That's all I wanted them to do, and they fulfilled it to the max.
That sounds like a great experience. Ostrich Fest.
The whole festival was terrific. There's one thing I want to share with you real quick about it as well. There was a thrill show as well. Like, it's unbelievable. I went to a thrill show and I saw Grand Funk in the same evening. Like, I pretty much crapped my pants. But the thrill show started off slow, but then they brought out something called either the Wheel of Destiny or the Wheel of Destruction. And a man by the name of Nathan Valencia got on this thing. I want you to picture like a giant human-sized hamster wheel, and then coming out from the top of it, about a 30-foot metal kind of tower with a weight on the other end. And in the middle of this long device, it's put on a hinge such that Nathan can get inside the hamster wheel, and if he starts running appropriately, he can make the whole apparatus spin to where the hamster wheel is now on the top, and he's, whoa, like 30 feet in the air. Did you follow that description at all, Steele?
I think so. Imaginatively, I'm just kind of in awe right now.
Again, I'm not usually the kind of guy to yell in a crowd. I'm just a nice guy. But this guy had me on the edge of my seat. He was inside the wheel, and then he's like, hey, do you guys want to see me do this on the outside of the wheel? And I did want to see it, Steele, but also I didn't because I was terrified for the guy's life. So I was yelling, don't do it, Nate! No! And then he did it, and it was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Okay, Dave, you remember when I was telling you about the Tommy Bartlett show? The water skiing show that had no water?
Yes, yes.
They had a couple. That was the thing I was trying to describe, where the couple was about to die. They were doing something like the Wheel of Destiny, but they were like probably mid-40s and not in no shape to be doing this. And I think, my opinion, they came within a few inches of falling and dying. It was not even pleasurable to see. It was really, really scary. I was like, no, no, please. We didn't pay anything. You don't need to do this for us. Just go home and live another day. But if a professional, like if I could see Nate do it, I can understand the thrill appeal.
And even then, like, even though you knew Nate was good at it, like, there's a few times he kind of stumbled. I don't know if he was stumbling theatrically or if he was actually stumbling. Either way, it was awesome. And I was scared for Nate. I wanted to hug him at the end, but we had to get over there for Grand Funk. We couldn't mess around anymore.
That sounds great, Dave.
Ostrich Festival is awesome, Steele. We just, anytime there's a festival with an animal in it, I think you just got to get out there and do it. But it's March. You want to talk a little bit about March Madness.
Oh, man.
Basketball's happening.
Yeah, I do love basketball. It's a beautiful game. I still play it once a week at a church ball. So it's pretty violent, pretty vicious. But there's nothing like the NCAA tournament. March Madness is the most fun, compelling basketball binge time of year. Just great.
It is. It's exciting. Everybody gets into the tournament. Like the secretary at work is filling out the bracket. Even if she's never watched a game in her life, she's still excited about March Madness. So what's one of your earliest exciting memories about the tournament?
I love those buzzer beaters, you know, the kind of moments where and the first memory mm-hmm. for me was a very famous, if you're in the Midwest, especially Indiana, this is super famous. It's known as The Shot. And it was when Bryce Drew from Valparaiso made a buzzer-beating three-pointer. This would have been, what, mid-90s? And it was probably my first most memorable NCAA buzzer beater. He ended up playing in the NBA, so he was a decent player. But his dad, Homer, was the coach. So he's like this coach's son. 1998, they're playing Ole Miss. And Valparaiso's, I think, a 13 seed, first round game. And he hits this game winner, three pointer. Incredible ending.
So, Steele, I've been in a hospital room before with like a really sick patient. And there's been a basketball game on that the patient's been watching. It was actually a Spurs playoff game. and someone nailed a buzzer beating three, and like I shouted out, "Yes!" Even though there was a what's so exciting? Why is the buzzer beater so exciting?
Well, because it's the thing where like they've had this 40-minute tightly contested game, and usually just the seconds before, there's been like free throws or a lead change, and in college, these games are so overcoached that the coaches are calling like 14 timeouts. So the end game has already taken like half an hour. And then it comes down to it, and then somebody pulls up for a long-distance shot, and the whole game just hangs in the balance for the one shot. And it seems like such an almost cruel, unfair way to settle this game that's been really tightly contested for so long. But depending on what happens with that shot, the team either wins or loses. It's like the most elemental part of basketball. And when it's the tournament, if the shot goes in, the team plays the next round, and if it goes out, they go home. They're done. It couldn't be higher stakes. And that, for me, is really what makes the buzzer beaters compelling.
And so my earliest memory, or at least one that I'm thinking of kind of in relation to this, is for some reason in 1995, I jumped on the UCLA bandwagon. And so we were actually watching them play Missouri. They were down with 4.8 seconds left, and Tyus Edney was their point guard. I liked him particularly because he's not very tall. He's like 5'10", yeah, which is still well taller than me. But for a basketball player, that's like he's a little dude.
And he looked so young, too. He looked like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, compared to the other kids on the court, he's just this little guy just running around. And so they inbound pass to him, and he just takes it from one end of the court to the other for a layup. 4.8 seconds from one end of the court to the other, scores the game winner, saves the team, and they go on, they win the championship that year.
Yeah, that was the O'Bannon brothers, right? Were the twins?
I loved the O'Bannons. Like, I was living in New Jersey at the time, and the Nets, they drafted Ed O'Bannon, and I was like, yeah, now the Nets are going to be awesome. Ed O'Bannon's career never really worked out.
No.
But this is a part of my lifetime memories. Of Ed O'Bannon's significance nowadays?
Yeah, so he's filing this lawsuit about image rights against the NCAA.
Yeah, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? What do you think?
I have pretty extreme views on this, but I hope he wins and he gets every penny available. The NCAA is a corrupt, exploitative cartel. They're just the worst. College athletes are the labor. They're the ones producing the value. And they're being exploited. I mean, coaches making millions of dollars and scholarship athletes having one-year renewable scholarships and not being able to profit at all despite bringing in thousands and sometimes millions of dollars for their school. I think it's just ethically reprehensible. So I hope he wins.
And if I had had to guess your stance before I asked that question, it would have been that exact response. Okay. And I think I'm probably not quite as extreme as you, but obviously the NCAA is doing things wrong. I think that the athletes do get benefits, you know, and having the scholarships, having the meals, having a place to live and all that stuff. Those are great benefits, but it's true. People should not be profiting off of these kids. You shouldn't be making millions of dollars off of Ed O'Bannon when he's not seeing any of it.
And the thing is that's so interesting is that the NCAA tournament, like all of the NCAA's money and power comes from the sale of television rights to the men's basketball tournament. Not all, but the vast majority of it. They don't make money off the college bowl games anymore. That goes to the conferences and the schools. The NCAA makes, I don't think they make that much from it. It's still the basketball tournament. That's where it's like billions of dollars for the TV rights.
Because it's such an awesome spectacle.
It really is.
Yeah, it's so cool. There's nothing else like it in sports. And so, of course, everyone's going to tune in because it's just so exciting.
Yeah. My favorite part of the tournament, though, and this is probably everybody's favorite, it's hard not to love it, Cinderella stories, Dave. Nothing beats the Cinderella. When a double-digit seed makes the Sweet 16 or goes further, nothing warms my heart like that.
Why is that, Steele? Why do you think, because I'm the same way. I think most people are. Why are we so compelled by that? Why is that so cool?
I think it's because they're coming out of nowhere and they're playing really well. And so it makes you realize, like, who can predict this stuff, the randomness of sports. But also, in many cases, these teams have really interesting characters. Like, the people playing on these teams sometimes are just seem like really cool, interesting, weird guys that you wouldn't expect to be like college basketball stars because they're never going to make the big time. Sometimes they're like as wide as they are tall, like their big man's like 400 pounds and 6 foot three or whatever, but he's effective. You know, like they're not going to be NBA players, but they're great college players. And that makes it really interesting.
I think it kind of harkens to, you know, the feeling inside that we all have. We all kind of feel like an underdog in some respect or another. It's neat to be able to see someone that's not expected to do much to accomplish a lot. Because you always kind of feel, regardless of how much of an underdog you still feel like you have some greatness within you and you just want to show it. And so I think it's real exciting when those people get to show their greatness when it wasn't expected, yeah.
And the other thing about it, I think, is that there are teams in college basketball that it's so easy to hate. And everybody hates different teams, but the teams that people hate are always the big, successful programs. Like, a huge chunk of America hates Duke. A big chunk of America hates Kentucky. A bunch of America probably hates North Carolina and Kansas. And there's people out there that hate UCLA or whatever. So those are the programs you expect people to hate or whatever. And it's even better when a Cinderella plays them and knocks them off. Like, I can't tell you how happy I feel every year when an underdog beats Duke. In 2007, I was so happy. I remember Eric Maynor. This guy was incredible. He single-handedly won his conference tournament with like one of the most unreal performances you've ever seen. He makes a three, he makes a free throws. He steals the ball in the backcourt like on two consecutive possessions. He's laughing and clapping his hands with his team down because he knows he's just owning the game. And they end up winning. They go to the tournament, they beat Duke, and he basically does it on his own. He just destroys Duke. And it was, I think, Greg Paulus's team. And everybody hated Greg Paulus. And Maynard just eviscerated him. It was the greatest feeling. And then I remember watching when Lehigh beat Duke a couple of years ago, and Duke losing first round to a 15 seed. The level of joy is hard to describe. There's few things in sports that feel so good as seeing like a hated team lose to a huge underdog.
It makes me think of, you know, the Christmas movie, A Christmas Story. You know that one?
Yeah, definitely.
So it just makes me think of the scene where Ralphie finally has enough with the bully. And he just takes him down and just pounds him until he just pounds the dude until he's bloody. And his mom eventually has to get him off of the kid. And it's like the most satisfying scene in any movie because he finally stands up to this kid that's just such a jerk.
Yeah. So Cinderellas. My favorite Cinderella, I think, is probably tied. I loved in 2006 the George Mason team. Do you remember this team, Dave?
Steel. I remember it all too well. You may or may not recall that I attended law school in 2005 through early 2006.
At George Mason University. That's why I was asking.
So, still, you may or may not remember that I dropped out of law school shortly before the tournament started that year. I was not doing well, and I hated it. So I dropped out, and I got out of there. And so this run to the Final Four felt like they were just spiting me. They were just kind of rubbing my face in it.
Oh, so it was really salt in the wound.
Yeah, like, hey, you couldn't hack law school, could you? Well, I'm going to make you think about it as much as possible.
I didn't know that, Dave, but I'm really glad I picked them as one of my favorite Cinderellas. The other one that I really loved was 2010. University of Northern Iowa, who apparently are really good this year, but they played Kansas and beat Kansas, who was like a big time. I think they were just coming off winning the national title the year before. And they had that guy that you'll never forget, Ali Farukhmanesh. And I remember it's near the end of the game. Northern Iowa's up by one or two. They get a steal. Farukhmanesh has got like a one-on-two. And normally you expect him to pull the ball out and just hold it, run the clock down. He pulls up for three on a fast break. And just takes it, no conscience, and makes it. It was the most exciting thing. I was like, did he just do that? I can't believe it. He pulled up for three on the fast break, up two with like 30 seconds left, and he made it. Huge stones.
That reminds me of we both attended the same university, Steele. The greatest BYU basketball player in recent memory, Jimmer Fredette.
Oh, man.
Did you jump on board with this at all? Were you on Jimmer's team here?
You know, it was fun to watch him. I don't think I had as strong of an attachment as a lot of people did. But, boy, that year in the tournament, I think it was the Mountain West tournament or whatever that year, he scored like 52 in one game. It was just obscene.
I remember that one of the years he was in the tournament, my parents came and they were doing a backpack trip with me and my wife. And so we were driving out into the desert in Arizona, kind of middle of nowhere. But it was right during the BYU game. And BYU hadn't won a tournament game in years. So we had to find it on the radio somehow, and we did. And so we had to stay in the SUV we were in. We couldn't start our hike until we knew if BYU had won or not. And they did. It was super exciting.
Driveway moments, they call them. That's great.
Yeah.
Do you have favorite or most memorable players from the NCAA tournament of past years, Dave?
I wish I could remember this guy's name. I want to look him up real quick. But Kansas, they in the early 90s, they weren't that good yet. But they made their first big run, and their big player was a white guy, a center. And I just remember him because it kind of scarred my mind, because every time he goes up for a rebound, he just had the hairiest armpits in the world. And we were living in Kansas at the time, so we were rooting for him. And I was like, oh, that guy's great. And then he'd reach up for the board, and like I'd have to look away from the TV. But I was a huge fan of that guy.
Was it Greg Ostertag?
It was before Greg.
I have a couple of favorites, Dave. One was from that Northern Iowa team. They had a guy in their team. I wonder what he's doing now. I bet he works at like a tire salesman or something. His name was Lucas O'Rear, which is the best Irish last name ever, O'Rear. And he had like red mop of hair, and he had mutton chops, like curly mutton chops, full on sideburns. He was their banger. He's like a power forward, 6'4", undersized. And he had a huge shamrock tattoo on one of his shoulders. And he did not look like a basketball player. He just looked like a roly-poly dumpy dude out there. But he held it together, man. He banged with Kansas, and I thought this guy, he was like, his wrists were all taped up, and he just looked like a warrior. He was the best.
I love it when there's a power forward that's just tiny, like, or way shorter than normal, but he's just kind of a bulky dude. It's just exciting.
They're so good. The other favorite was, I have a friend here in Madison, and he and his college buddies, every year what they do is they go to a vacation rental home on Lake Michigan. And this is like the second or third weekend of March or whatever, so the weather is always bad, so this place is empty. They get like an 8-bedroom house, and all these friends gather from all over the country for the first weekend of the tournament. And she just, that's when there's like back-to-back-to-back-to-back games of this Saturday and Sunday or whatever. So you just watch the whole first weekend of the tournament from the Field of 64 down to the Sweet 16. And they do it every year. And it's this amazing gathering. I've gone a couple times. It's been awesome. In 2013, Creighton team had Doug McDermott, who was their star, and was great because he wore shirt sleeves under his jersey, you know, like a tall, awkward white guy with shirt sleeves. Hard to beat.
Always good. But it's because he's covering center. Up the pit hair. That's what he's doing still.
He probably was. He knew he had sensitive viewers back there in Nebraska. But his center was this Venezuelan guy named Gregory Echenique. Loved him because two reasons. He wore 00, which is the always best good number. If you're a center and you wear 00, you're the best. Kevin Duckworth. That's all you got to say. And they weren't quite rec specs, but they were like those tinted sunglasses that Antoine Carr used to wear.
Oh, yeah.
So he had eyewear and a 00, and he had like a real thin goatee, and he was balding. He looked like he was like a 35-year-old rec league player, and won my heart.
All it takes is a guy wearing glasses and playing some type of athletic competition, and you're in.
It's true. I love it. So did you look up the guy's name? Do we know who he is?
Mark Randall. Mark Randall's his name. Kansas. Wow. Just a nice, healthy amount of pit hair, and he wasn't ashamed of it. He led him pretty deep in the tournament that one year, and I don't think he had much of a pro career, but he played in the NBA a little bit. So No glasses, so you probably wouldn't be the biggest fan, but
Dave, I have to say, for the listeners, there's one other thing I need to talk about, and this is tangentially connected to March Madness. But the greatest thing about the NCAA tournament is obviously the bracket. And great brackets
yes.
exist outside of basketball. My favorite bracket happens usually around the time of March Madness every year. It's called Name of the Year. They have a 64-name bracket. These are real names collected from around the world, and people vote for the best name of the year. It's at nameoftheyear.com. It is the best bracket I have ever seen in my life.
Are people submitting the names? Where are they getting the names?
So they've been doing this since 1994. A bunch of, I think, Ivy League guys got together and just collected weird names. Oftentimes, college sports has some really inventive names. Oftentimes, people who get arrested for strange things have strange names. So you just check that out. There was a woman, I think her name was Destiny Frankenstein, who was like a high school, or no, she was a college softball player.
Uh-huh.
Last year's winner, Seamus Beaglehole. Seamus Beaglehole. I think he was like an Aussie Rules football player, and he beat Chili Poon.
Oh, boy. That had to be a tight race there.
It was a very tight race. Dr. Eve Gruntfest, Al Capone Cruz Ballas, Chewbacca Hung, Dr. Loki Sky Lizard, Carjon de Porcha, Curvaceous Bass. That was a really good one. My favorite one, though, I think, was Genghis Cohen. It wasn't Genghis Khan. Genghis Cohen, the Jewish accountant. Shatavius Cook, Fazwaz Wazwaz. I mean, there's 64 incredible names every year. You just can't go wrong.
You've probably seen the Key and Peele sketch that they do of they're doing like a college football all-star game, and they're just standing in front of the camera introducing themselves, and like all of these names would definitely fit in there.
Yeah, this is like that, but real life. It's so good.
I just went to the site. The 2011 winner, Dr. Taco BM Monster.
You know, I was really disappointed that year. I remember I was following this very carefully. There was Colonel Many Bears Grinder, and I really wanted him to do better than he did. There was Shalom Dream Peace Compost that year, I remember. Flamer Castrati. That was a good one. Anyway, but yeah, Taco BM Monster tore through the bracket.
Yeah, it seems like he tore through a lot of things, I would think. Well, that's a terrific bracket. And if anybody out there has other really neat, awesome brackets to share, like email them to us. We love this kind of stuff. So March Madness, I'm excited. I'm going to watch. I'm pulling for, I hope BYU gets in there this year and makes some noise. I'm excited. But not as excited as I am for the next segment still.
Great.
I lost the plot. This movie, I saw this not that long ago. I was very excited about it. I wanted to bring it on the show with you. Backdraft. Have you ever seen this show? You know anything about this?
You know, I have seen this. This is a great film. Let me tell you a little bit about what I remember. So Backdraft is your classic heist film mixed with time travel, mixed with a little bit of creative consumer fraud. Because here's what happens. You've heard about backdating checks.
Yes.
It's kind of based on that premise. And backdrafting is this very elaborate financial fraud where you write these post-dated checks, and they built a really elaborate kind of spy thriller out of the whole premise, Backdraft.
And give me, who were some of the characters in this? Like, who did you enjoy being a part of this with?
So Wesley Snipes was in it. He drove the film.
Always
he
did.
He was like a banker by day, big kind of martial arts hero by night.
Yes.
And the thing was, he needed money to pay for he had this rare blood disorder, and he needed to have surgery, and they had to repair it. I don't remember all the medical details. I wish I had taken better notes, because you could have explained the science behind it.
Yes,
but anyway, he doesn't have health insurance. He lost his job at this high-powered investment firm, lost his health insurance. So he says, I need to pay for this blood surgery that I'm going to have. And so he starts doing these backdrafted checks.
Those are top of the line. That's expensive stuff.
Yeah, blood surgery. So he starts doing these backdrafted checks, and he realizes that he's going to get caught unless he can figure out the top end bank's security certificates for how they authenticate million-dollar checks. Because you can't just walk in off the street and cash a million-dollar check. It has to be printed on the special paper with all the watermarks, you know, very high-tech. So what he does is he stumbles upon this system for – it's for time travel, but it's not the time travel like you're used to. It's short-term time travel. So he will mm-hmm. – he's only able to jump about a month into the future. But what he does is he waits mm-hmm. – until a bank is about to come out with a new security development in their checks. He jumps forward a month. He grabs like 1,000 of these checks that in the future when they're kind of commonplace. He jumps back. And so now he has these security certificate-enabled checks. He backdates them, takes them to the bank, cashes them. And he's just making millions, hands over fist.
That's the backdraft, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of backdraft. But it's not entirely all of it. Because he gets his blood surgery, and the thing is, up to this point, you're along with him. You're like, yeah, it's a Robin Hood story. He's doing good, and he makes all these promises along the way. He's going to donate to build a children's hospital to help cure other blood surgery diseases that other kids mm-hmm. have. But the problem is, Dave, he gets addicted not to the time travel, but to the money, and so he gets his stuff corrected. But he can't stop backdrafting these checks. He just keeps going. Mm. And it eventually becomes a really elaborate detective thriller. And so there's a detective who's slowly piecing together the pieces of what Wesley Snipes is doing. It's Tommy Lee Jones. He plays this grizzled detective.
I thought this was Tommy's role, yeah, from what I understood, yeah.
So he's this grizzled detective, and his partner is played by a really up-and-coming young female actress. I don't remember her name, Dave. What was her name?
Wasn't this a role that this was a Jodie Foster, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, it was Jodie Foster. So Jodie Foster is just like, she's like an Ivy League grad, but she's not very street smart. But she's the kind of technical expert. She's the one who's been trained in counterfeit detection techniques.
Uh-huh.
And so the way they end up busting the case wide open is what she does. This is really clever. She says, I think what this guy is doing is stealing these notes from the future and trying to catch them in the present. So she has this bank release a bunch of certificate, like new checks, mm-hmm. but they're fakes. They're not actually the ones the bank use. So if he presents it at a bank, he'll think it's real. But it was just a fake release. They're not actually using them. Does that make sense? I'm a little confused.
Oh, yeah. It's a very coherent plot, yes.
Yeah. So as he's backdrafting one last time, he just keeps saying, one last time. But it was one last time too many. And the thing is, he can't let go. He goes in. He knows the net's tightening. He cashes his last backdrafted check. And he's walking out. Tommy Lee Jones comes up to arrest him. He doesn't want to be arrested, draws his weapon, and there's this like big, massive firefight. And the movie ends tragically. I mean, I could describe it, but I don't want to spoil it for everybody. But in the end, you learn crime doesn't pay. And the real sad part is his blood disease was cured for him, but not for everyone. And it's infectious. And because the movie ends with his blood kind of spilling in the street, the implication is that it's going to seep into the sewers or the water and that thousands of people may be at risk because of Wesley Snipes' greed.
I believe they were setting up for a sequel, but they never could get the funding for that.
Yeah, they didn't get the budget. So that was Backdraft. So,
that's I think you nailed it, Steele. I didn't think that you would have seen this film, but you got it, huh?
Yeah, so I liked it. I mean, psychological.
But in actuality, it was genres. An amazing starring vehicle for Kurt Russell involving firefighting. And still, I'm not going to go into the whole film with you, but I want to tell you one scene from the film. Towards the end, there's someone that's an arsonist that's been setting fires. Kurt Russell is trying to catch this guy with the help of one of the Baldwin brothers. They're inside a burning building, and they figure out who it is that's been setting the fires there. So all three of them are inside this burning building, and it's of course one of their best friends. He's been setting the fires. This guy looked out for him after their dad died in a fire. So Kurt Russell, he feels betrayed and hurt. Like, this guy's been setting the fires. But there's a physical confrontation between Kurt Russell and this bad man. A man comes at him with an axe, and he knocks Kurt Russell unconscious. But there's fire, so things are coming down in the building. Part of the catwalk they're on breaks, and it's going to go in. And Kurt Russell comes to. The bad guy's just hanging on by his hands. But Kurt Russell loves him because he kind of raised him when his dad died. And he reaches out, and he grabs his hand, and finally, this man's kind of come to his senses. He doesn't want Kurt to die, and he says, "Just let me go." And Kurt looks right at him, and he says, "You go, we go." Because he's not going to let him die.
Oh, Dave. What a hero.
So good. A little more intense than the check-cashing thriller that you put forward.
But tell you what, Dave, there's an untapped market for movies about backdated checks.
Yeah, if Wesley Snipes is in it and you can get Tommy Lee in, I'll watch it. I don't have a problem with that. I'd recommend anyone checking out Kurt Russell. And I told my wife after I watched Backdraft that I finally understand what it means to be a man. And I hope I've been fulfilling my role as a man a little bit better since then.
Every time you go out for ice cream, do you just look at Ariane in the eyes and say, "Hey, honey, you go, we go."
Oh, Kurt. He's a real hero. So our next section, Unchained Melodies. We got some good music for you today. Steel, one of my favorite bands of all time. You've probably heard some of their stuff. Have you listened to the Silver Jews at all?
Definitely.
They have everything I want in a band. Weird lyrics. They're not very good with their instruments. And the singer's voice is debatably terrible. So they hit all my sweet spots. I love them. This is off of his last album, We Could Be Looking for the Same Thing. And I just got word, I read it somewhere, that they're working on another record. But this song, I love it.
Sidewalks disappear, and up through bright blue blocks of sky, where the days turn to weeks into months of the year, and where together you and I, we could be looking for the same thing. If you're looking for someone, we could belong to each other. If you're not seeing,
let's steal that. He's singing with his wife there.
That's even sweeter.
Yeah. But the whole catalog is terrific. Just really interesting lyrics. Just really interesting thoughts. He's published a few volumes of poetry, which I know you'd love that sort of thing, Steele.
Yeah, I really love their song "Honk If You're Lonely."
Oh yeah, it's beautiful. What do you got for us this week, Steele?
Okay, Dave. This is a guy that I've fairly recently discovered that I just can't stop thinking about. He's so weird. He's a rapper, goes by the name Serengeti. You're going to love him because he has invented a persona. And the persona's name is Kenny Dennis. And Kenny Dennis is like this, I think, 40-something, 50-something-year-old dude from Chicago who's just into, like, Chicago stuff from the 80s. He's got a couple of albums where he raps as this guy, Kenny Dennis, that are really, really off the chain. And one of the songs that's really great, it's called Dennehy. And it's basically about the actor Brian Dennehy. But this guy, I feel like if you guys had been in the same generation, you guys would have been buddies. You would have loved the same action movies. You would have been in all the same stuff.
This goes out to my girl Jules. favorite actor, Dennehy. Favorite drink on bulls, bears, hawks, socks, bulls. Say goodbye a little longer like I ate a piece of Big Red. Grow a mustache the size of Mike Ditka's forehead. Hair comb to the side, looking like a piece of foam. Buick speakers, red cooler, 85 bear zubas, polar sausage, bratwurst. Walking like my cockers, Stacey Adams, no shirt. Jules to get a case of squirt. Wife's pissed cause I forgot to get the minute rice. So I'm back in the damn Buick to get a stinking bag of ice. To get a stinking bag of rice. My wife Jules is cute. Her taste really moved me like I ate juicy fruit. Had me dancing like Chris Penn and Footloose. 85 Walter Ruse, old style pack of cools. Go to Ace, no tolls and weed whacker fuel. 85 Bear Zubas, Stacey Adams got ruined. For the basement sump pump, shop vac, clean up. Cook brats, cook chops, your heat shouldn't be that hot. Keep your juices in the chops, keep your juices in the brats. Serve them on paper plates, tater salad and grape pop. My favorite actor was Dennehy long before he played Knight. When Behringer was a substitute, everything was going right. Even after Jordan left and Dave Corzine retired. Sean Dunstan's wild throws and Mike Ditka got fired. Favorite actor, Dennehy. Favorite drink on Bulls, Bears, Hawks, Sox, Bulls. Play softball with the guys.
That's great. It's interesting. How do people come up with this stuff? He's just like, oh yeah, I'll make up this guy, Kenny Dennis. He loves Chicago.
So this guy is cool because in addition to Serengeti, you know, he's formed this really interesting super band called Sisyphus, and it's Sufjan Stevens.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've heard of that.
Sun Lux and Serengeti. And they're very, uh-huh. very different in their musical styles and sensibilities. But he's the kind of hip-hop impresario in the group. And so he's a Chicago guy. So I think he just invented Kenny Dennis based on his life experiences. But he performed on the radio show Wits recently.
Uh-huh.
And he did a live version of a Sisyphus song called Rhythm of Devotion. That's just beautiful. It's a really lovely little love song. And I'll put that up on the website at the end of this episode.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I love it when people are doing just out there stuff. My next song is not quite as far out there. This is a band called Nightbeds. It's primarily just one guy. It's his vehicle. I first heard him do a song called Even If We Try, and the video of it was just haunting. It was just him kind of walking around one night, getting drunk and just being treated poorly by people. Like, I can't stop thinking about it sometimes. But last year he released a couple singles, and one of them was this one, Head for the Hills.
Take me back to the love, claim me, knowing that I'm off into the darkness, out deep, fucked by the savage herd.
Yeah, I like his voice. I like, and he just sings about interesting subjects.
Great voice.
Yeah.
I think a really nice use of dynamics. He goes quiet, loud, quite nicely.
Well, let's have you wrap this up. What do you got for us?
That was kind of a dreamy, ethereal voice. And this has been one of the really most haunting voices. It just got stuck in my head for weeks. This is Angel Olsen. She's a relatively young singer-songwriter. This was from an album called Strange Cacti. And the song is called Some Things Cosmic. One of those, I don't know what it is, almost like that Disney version of Cinderella. Isn't there a voice like that on that? I don't know.
I don't know. I was enchanted though. Still, I wasn't ready for it to fade out. It was just nice. I'll sit here and listen to that all day.
Good. She's a weird, weird woman.
That seems to be right up your alley.
Definitely.
So those are our songs for this week. And once again, this is an unheard of record. Steel is not doing book wisdom again. I think this is 3 weeks in a row. I'm going to let you do it next week, Steel. I know that you're just brimming with passages you want to share, but I have one for you.
Wonderful.
This is Raise High the Roof Beam Carpenters by J.D. Salinger. I think every, 18-year-old boy should have a J.D. Salinger phase where you read A Catcher in the Rye and read all of J.D. Salinger's short stories. If you're 18 and you're a male, you need to read all of them. It's just terrific. That's what I did. He wrote just a series of short stories about this one particular family. They just had really interesting interactions with each other and just really seemed to care for each other. One of the brothers came to New York for the weekend to see his brother's wedding, and this is a passage from that. When I checked into the bathroom with Seymour's diary under my arm and had carefully secured the door behind me, I spotted a message almost immediately. It was not, however, in Seymour's handwriting, but unmistakably in my sister Boo Boo's. With or without soap, her handwriting was always almost indecipherably minute, and she had easily managed to post the following message up on the mirror. Raise high the roof beam carpenters. Like Aries comes the bridegroom, taller far than a tall man. Love, Irving Sappho, formerly under contract to Elysium Studios Limited. Please be happy. Happy, happy with your beautiful Muriel. This is an order. I outrank everybody on this block. The contract writer, quoted in the text I might mention, has always been a great favorite at appropriate staggered and time intervals with all the children in our family, largely through the immeasurable impact of Seymour's taste in poetry on all of us. I read and reread the quotation, and then I sat down on the edge of the bathtub and opened Seymour's diary. So he just stumbled into his brother's apartment, found the diary, and he wanted to keep other people from reading it, so he grabbed it and decided to read a little bit of it himself. But on the mirror, both of their sisters wrote that message, which I love. Raise high the roof beam carpenters, like Aries comes the bridegroom, taller far than a tall man. After I first read this, Steel, I started writing positive messages on bathroom mirrors all the time. I just really liked that idea of just walking into the bathroom and someone's written like a message to lift you up.
Dave, my parents used to do that when they were first married. When the mirrors get all steamed up, you know, you can write something there and the next person who steams up the mirror will see it. So they would take a warm shower, it would be all steamed up, and then my dad would write some kind of love message, or my mom would write some kind of love message to my dad, so that when they took a shower next, they would see what the person before had carved into the mirror. I just thought that was so sweet, knowing that my parents communicated like that.
That is, it's beautiful. So I'd say still write a nice message to Laurel on the mirror. Do it. It's wonderful.
Thanks, Dave. I will.
All right. Well, thanks, Steel. Thanks for talking. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I feel like we snuggled up on that couch. We got cozy again. We could bring in a guest. Our relationship's rock solid now.
Yeah, I feel comfortable again.
Off the chain. It's off the chain. Welcome to this world. It's off the chain.
That was the year of Vernon Lee Bad Marriage Jr.
It sounds like he could be the bassist for a 70s rock band. Vernon Lee Bad Marriage.
Yeah, his guitarist was named Solo Alone.
Yeah, he's just a cute little man.
They'll eat anything, too, apparently. They'll just metal, whatever. They take it out of your hand and swallow it, and you gotta wait for him to poop it out.